This is, I think, going to be our last share on that Gemara on Kuf Bet, right? You know that again. There's many Agadot in a row on Kuf Bet, but this is, I think, the last one we're going to do on that. Now, this is an interesting one because you're never really sure whether the main point. Sometimes it's hard to tell whether an Agadot that is doing Parshanut on a story in Tanakh. If its primary goal is to actually give you Parshanut and Tanakh, and along the way it's giving you a ethical lesson, or if the primary goal is the ethical lesson and the Parshanut of the in the story is less primary, and therefore it might be taking artistic license with the story. So what I want to do in this one is, there's clearly a claim being made about the story of Shaul, but there's also an ethical lesson being taught. So we do need to figure out what is the parshanut that's happening in the story, what is the ethical lesson, and then figure out, right, which of those is primarily, and you know, and what that tells us about whether we really think this is pshat that is trying to figure out in the story. Okay, so I made this on the plane, so I actually did. Give you the whole Gemara. But if you look in the Gemara, if you remember, the Gemara had in the middle of the story, on Kuf Bet, said Moshe Rabbeinu is a king. Right? So, Mativ Rava, Rabbi Shmuel Omer, Yiva Amar. Yiva Amar Melech. Actually, no, let's go back one more line, right? So if you remember, the Gemara had been talking about, is Moshe a king, right? That's what we talked about last time. So the Gemara had said, Amar Ula, Bikesh Moshe Malchut, Velo Nat Nulo. Moshe wanted to be king, and God didn't give it to him. Dichtiv, Al Tikrav Halo. It says, don't draw hither, as they translate it. Do not draw hither here. Vein Halom Ela Malchut. And halom is malchut, shneemar, mi anochi Hashem Elokim, ki aviatani ad halom, right? That when David went before Hashem, right, he said to him, who am I that you brought me hither? And then the Gemara says, Mativ Rabba, Rabbi Shmuel, Omer Yivama Melech. How can you say he's not a king? The Braita had said he was a king. So Amar Rava, lo lizaro kamar. He is a king, but his sons weren't kings. Now, right off the bat, we already talked about this with Moshe. This is at some level a contradiction because in Tanakh, the definition of a king, at least an ideal king, is one who has a dynasty. How do I know? Give me a few proofs. Well, so earlier you get that by Gidon, that when they say, I want you to be a king, they say, you'll be a king, i.e., you and your children will rule. Right, that the implication, the default, is that a king is dynastic. Now, obviously, there are kings who are assassinated before that happens and stuff like that, but the default is that. And yes, as Graeber notes, the blessing to kings is always you and your children will have a successful dynasty. The curse will always be you won't, by Malchut, by David, etc. So saying that Moshe was king but his children weren't is either saying he's a king but only him, or he's saying he's a king but not really a king because he's a king without a dynasty, which is a limited type of king. So then the Gemara says, "V'kol hecha dechtiv halom l'dorahu." Is it true that whenever it says hither, halom, that means for generations? Now, I want you to be very careful. What does l'dorot mean? What can l'dorot mean? Good, so generations. What can that mean? That can mean one of two things. What? No. It can either mean, if I say, right, Lidore Dorot, for the generations of generations, what do I mean? Forever. So what can Lidorot mean? Either forever or just you and, you know, there will be a few. It doesn't mean forever, but it means more than you. So The Gemara says, halom ledorot, is it true that whenever it says halom, it means forever? V'hagabe Shaul, tichtiv hava ad halom. When Shaul is appointed in Perek Yud, Pasuk Kavet, Shmuel Aleph, it says, is there a man who comes halom? Which implies ish who? In who? Sorry, ish who? In Zaro lo. That he was a king, right? He was going to be a king, but not his children. So, what seems to be the implication of the Gemara at this stage, right? So, because we're making a big claim right now about Shaul's kingdom, which is that what? That he was never supposed to be a dynastic king. No, let's be very precise. He obviously wasn't really a dynastic king, but we'll see that. But it sounds like he was never supposed to be a dynastic king. Meaning, because, and how do I know? Because this quote is from where?
When he gets anointed.
When Shmuel actually anoints him as king. So if you think that from the very first moment, he's not supposed to be king for generations, then that tells you that, right, he was never supposed to be dynastic king. Why? So now what I want to ask you is, that is making a very extreme claim about the nature of Shaul's kingdom, was that it was never supposed to go beyond him. Okay, why would anyone say that? Right? What would drive someone to say that Shaul was not supposed to be king forever? Why is that clear? And that's what I'm asking you. Where do you get that from? I told you to bring a Tanakh, so pray tell, right? Why? Remember I said the default, you go back to the story of Gidon, right? I'll read it to you, right? Here, in Gidon, it says as follows, right? So if you open up to Shoftim, right? So after, what? Right, so 1 second, right? So if you look in Shoftim, Perek Chet, Vayomru Ish Yisrael El Gidon, Mishal Banu, Gam Ata, Gam Bincha, Gam Ben Bincha, Kirshatan Merbian. You, your son, and your son's son should be king because you saved us. And what does he say? Vayomru El Gidon, Lo Mishal Nibachem, Lo Mishal Benibachem, Adonai Mishal Bachem. Not me, but God. But like when they ask him to be a ruler, the implication is that is going to be dynastic. So it would be sort of strange if Shaul was never meant to be a king. That would be a dynastic king. That would seem very, very odd. Right? It would be very, very odd to me if that was the case. Correct. He definitely loses his king later on because his kingship later on because he messes up, right? Well, he messes up and therefore he loses his kingdom at some level in his lifetime, meaning. Yes, he sort of stays king till his death, but he's already losing power and losing his mind, and David is taking over. So it's not clear that this is the case. But what? Sort of. One second, right? So the claim being made here is quite strange. It seems to be saying that he was never supposed to be king, a dynastic king, right? Now the Gemara. One second. So why would you say this? So what? Well, is it? What evidence do you have about that? And God says, appoint him, and they find someone who at the beginning is really righteous. No, he was shichmo lamala. He was head and shoulders, literally, above the entire country. He was a prophet. What do you mean? He was a prophet. God gives him his spirit. He's described as humble, right? Every good thing that you could think of is how Shaul is described. I'm not making this up. Read the book. I quote Tanakh. I quote Tanakh. V'lo haya ben shmo Shaul. Bachur vatov. He was young and good. This is Tanakh speaking. Ve'ein ish b'nei Yisrael tov mimenu. No one in the entire Jewish people better than him. Mishichmo v'mala gavoa mikala am. Head and shoulders above anybody else. Yeah, but that doesn't sound that way.
It doesn't sound that bad, no. But if you're looking for ways to say...
When Shmuel says, I want you to be king, the first thing he says... Hello, Vinyamini Anochi, I'm a nobody. Miktani Shifte Israel, Vinyamin. Why are you talking about it? And what does he say to him? What does he say to him? Right, he just anoints him, he kisses him. He says, God has anointed you. He becomes a Navi, right? And all the Jewish people look at him in the next parak when he actually appointed and say, he's the best, right? Yechi HaMelech, right? And the people who don't, they eventually come around. So I don't, right? So, and like I said, you have to figure out, is it trying to make a narrative point in Tanakh, yes or no? So I think the question you need to ask is, well, if it's making a narrative point in Tanakh, then you need to explain why what?
Why Tanakh will against
it? Why what? It doesn't say he's going to be forever. It doesn't say it explicitly. But what would be the motivation to say that he's not, right? That you need a svara, right? No? You need a svara. So what's the svara? What's the svara? Right? Why would anyone say something like this? I don't understand. Why would anyone say anything like this? So my guess is there is one reason why you might say this, and that is... the Malchut is promised to Yehuda. Back in Bereishit.
Still,
and in Dvarim, right?
So okay, so
you
have it for 5 years, for 5 generations.
Okay, fine, but that... Graber says, so you could have it for 5 generations. But what does that come down to in the Gemara? Very good. That's exactly what I'm getting to. Does Ladarot mean forever, where, because we know there's a promise to David, to Yehuda, it seems not to be forever. If you think it just means for more than one generation, then he might be. However, it's even not clear, because is it clear that a non-Yehuda king can't be king dynastically forever? Is that clear? Okay, good. Why is it not clear? Give me proof. I'm going to ask you for...
Yehuda has to be a king, but doesn't mean it's somebody else. It can't be. As long as Yehuda has at least one round.
Oh, very good. Give me proof from Chazal that Melech Beit David can be, that needing a Melech from Yehuda or David doesn't preclude the possibility of having another king. Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Kud Bet, which says that God said to Yeravam, right? Exactly. Be good, and you, me, and Ben Yishai will walk together in Gan Eden, which makes it sound like it'll be forever. An Amr Lo, right?
Then he says,
Me Barosh, but who goes first? And he says, Ben Yishai Barosh. Right? Yes, you will be a secondary king, but it'll be the David first. He says, Ihachi Lobin, I don't want it. Right? Which means that Agadata entertains the possibility that alongside a Judahite king or Davidic king, there could be another king. But my guess is that what's partially driving this Gemara is this question. Is the reason you would say he's not forever is if you think that it's promised to Yehuda and you're not buying that Agadic tradition that you could have another king alongside. That's the first daya. The second daya Gemara is Ibayit Ema Ha Have Ishboshet. The next daya in the Gemara is he did have Dorot, namely his son was king, Ishboshet. Now, what is this line in the Gemara is clearly understanding Dorot to mean what, Draper? Exactly. Not forever. Just in order to be a king, you need continuity of any sort. But now this is a weird machloket. Why is this a weird machloket? No. Because Ishboshet really was king. So there's two ways of understanding the Havamina and Maskana of this Gemara, the two Deyot in the Gemara. One possibility is the Gemara... First day is convinced Dorot means forever, and the second one means it means one generation, or...
The first one is convinced that his mom was actually...
Exactly. Or Ishbosheth was king, but they're arguing about whether his kingship counted. Now, that's a very interesting parshanut machloket. Why would you have a machloket about whether Ishbosheth's malchut counted? Was Ishbosheth? Who is Ishbosheth? You looked at me like I'm crazy. Who is Ishbosheth? Oh, good God. What is with you people? This is why I said you need a Tanakh, or you just need to have read Tanakh at some point in your life. Oh, for God's sake. Who is Ishbosheth? I just told you who Ishbosheth is. This isn't a secret. This is not like some secret midrash. It's his son. It's Shaul's son who does become king. He does become king. But what's the problem? Is when does he become king? What had already happened by this point? Very good. Is that at this point in the story, David had already been made Bet. Shmuel Bet, Perek Bet. Right? So, right? So Shmuel Bet, Shaul dies, right? David is now king. Is he king over all of Am Yisrael? No. Right? He is not. And at this point, there are still people maintaining the rebellion, They're opposing David's rebellion against Shaul, namely the people of Yavesh Gilad. And then in Perek, Shmuel Bet, Parek Bet, Pasuk Chet, Ve'avner ben Ner sarat sava asher l'Shaul lakach et Ishboshet ben Shaul v'ayveru machanayim. So Avner, the general of Shaul, takes Ishboshet v'yamlicheu el Gilad v'el Asheri v'el Yisrael v'el Ephraim v'el Binyamin v'el Yisrael kulo, and he makes him king over the Gilad, which is part of Menashe, right? Asheri Yisrael al Ephraim, meaning v'el Binyamin, which means mostly over Bnei Yosef. Ephraim, Menashe, and Bnei Yosef. Ben Arbaim, Shana, Ishboshet, Ben Shol, Ben Malcho, Yisrael. Now, the Pasuk calls him a king. He was a king at 40. Ushtaim, Shana, Malach. He's king for 2 years. Ach, Beit Yehuda, Hayu, Acharei, David. But the Davidic family, the Yehuda is after David. Vahi, Mispar, Yamim, Asher, Hayah, David, Melech, Bechavon, Beit Yehuda, Sheva, Shana, Vishish, Chadashim. And during that time, David is in Chevron for 7.5 years. And then if you remember the story, what happens? Apparently you don't remember the story because you don't remember he existed. Vayetze Avner Ben-Er Vavdei Yishboshet Ben-Shol Machanayim Givona. Right, so then you get the play battle, remember? Yoav and Avner meet up and they say, let our people fight, and then it turns into a real battle and people get killed. And then Avner ends up killing Asael, the brother of Yoav. And then Yoav tries to take revenge. He doesn't yet. Right? He doesn't yet. When does he take? So Parak Gimel tells you, "Vadiya milchama aruka bein Beit Shaul ven Beit David, veDavid olech chazek Beit Shaul holchim veDalim." There's war, a long war between the Shaul, the Beit Shaul, and Beit David, and David is getting stronger while Shaul's family is getting weaker. Okay, and then what happens in Pasuk Zion? What happens? Vav really. So this war is going on. What is the one thing that's keeping Shaul's malchut going? Avner, the powerful general. Shaul pilegesh, ushma ritzpavar ayah, ayomer levner, madua batal pilegesh avi. And then Ishboshet said, Shaul had a pilegesh. Now in general, is anybody but a king allowed to marry the wife of a king? No. Ishboshet accuses Avner of sleeping with his father's Pilegesh. Okay? Now, it's not clear that this is true, right? The Radak assumes he was Choshesh. Right? It's not clear that this actually happened, but he suspects it. And he accuses him. Vayichar l'Avner ma'od al divrei Ishboshet. And he gets very angry. Vayomer, what does he say? Harosh kelev anochi, asher li Yehuda. What am I, the head of a dog of Yehuda? Hayom, right? Hayom es echesed in Beit Shaul avicha elachi velmareo velo im titicha biyad David. But go to light avon haisha hayom. I didn't give you over to David, and you're accusing me of this. Ko yaseh Elohim laavner v'cho yosif lo ki kasher nishba Adonai David kichen eselo. And therefore, I swear that that which God already promised to David, I will make sure happens today. Meaning, I already know that God promised he would be king, and I'm going to make it happen. La'avir ha'mamlacha mi'beit Shaul, u'la'akim et kisei David al Yisrael va'yuda midan vad ber sheva. To make the malchut in the house of Shaul, and that he's going to be king over all of Am Yisrael. And Ishboshet couldn't say anything to Avner because he was afraid of him. And immediately, so he sends a letter and he says, I'll make a deal with you right now. I'm going to make you king over everybody. Right? And David says, fine, but first you need to bring me Michal bat Shaul. You need to bring me my wife. So he does. He storms, right? He goes, and he sends David. David says, messengers, give me my wife. And he takes, right? And Ishboshet has no choice and gives him his wife, right? Takes her from Palti ben Laish. And by Yud Zayin, Udvar Avner Ayan Zikne Yisrael, David. And what does Avner do? He goes to this kingdom, and what does he say to them? Oh, you always wanted David to be king anyways. You always wanted it. So now it's time. Let's do what God wants. Va'ata asuti Adonai amar al David le'mor biyad David avdi oshiyat ami Yisrael miyad plushim miyad kol oyveihem. God said this is going to happen. And then he tells Binyamin. And he comes to him. David gives it, you know, they work together. He does it. And then what happens? Yoav gets angry. Yoav hears about it. And why does Yoav get angry? Because he killed his brother, Asael. And he's probably jealous. He's also, right? So what does he do? He kills him. And what does David then need to do? Mourn Avner very publicly to make it clear that he didn't kill him, so that, right? But this is the end of Ishboshet's reign. And this is basically, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know what you...
What?
And then by Perek Dalid, right, what happens? They bring him his head. Right? That there are assassins who kill Ishbosheth, bring his head to David, right? Rechav and Baana. And David, surprisingly, how does he react? He kills them. They think that he's going to be celebrated for assassinating his rival. No. These are servants of Ishbosheth that say, they see how the wind is, right? They see the tides shifting. They're like, let's kill Ishbosheth and bring as a peace offering to David the head, literally the head of his enemy. And David says, right? This is Perek Dalid. He kills them, cuts off their hands and feet, hangs them up, right? And makes it very clear that it was not his doing. Because again, David wants to cement his power, so he wants to show that he's not vindictive against Mishpachat Shaul. So now if I come back and I ask you, what is the machloket in the Gemara? These two lines in the Gemara, one line in the Gemara says, seems to say that, so one possibility is the machloket between line one and line two is literary, which is, does Lidorot mean forever or simply more than you? But I think the more likely explanation is, we know that Ishbosheth was king for 2 years. But by time he was king, there's a few things that are true. First of all, he's not king over the whole nation. He's only over basically Bnei Yosef. Second of all, the general is the one holding the power. And even his general recognizes that God wants David to be king. And as soon as he has a slight to his honor, he says, let's do what God already wanted. Which means that if I asked you, was Ishbosheth really king? Well, you could see it both ways. On the one hand, does the Pasuk say he was king? Yes. The Pasuk says he was king. On the other hand, he was king over not all of Am Yisrael, when David was already an acting king, and everybody, including his own general, who's making him king and protecting his malchut, acknowledges that God has already chosen David, and this is temporary, and as soon as his ego shifts, he says, let's do what God wanted anyways, sends a letter to David, and the next thing you know, David is king of all of Am Yisrael, and Ishbosheth is dead. So you understand why you could have a machloket. Ishbosheth, is he really king? Well, on the one hand, he says so. On the other hand, all the other evidence points to the fact that
not really.
What? Correct. Then, right, then, name only. Then the Gemara gives a third position. Okay? V'i bayit ema, alternatively, shiny Shaul, da'afilu bigaveh lokai. Or maybe Shaul is different because the malchut didn't even last for him. Meaning what? Exactly. Meaning what? So Rashi clarifies, Miu halom malchut olamit hu, kshapaskulo shom malchut olamit paskulo, hu garam latzon shadar menu. Meaning, now the third day, because the first 2 days assume that, so one day assumes that Shaul was king and was never supposed to be permanent. Possibly because he's not from Yehuda or something, right? Possibly, too, is Dorot doesn't mean forever. It just means dynastic. And he was. And this hangs on the machloket of whether you think Ishbosheth was a real king or not. The third daya is, no, Shaul was a king forever. We just took it away from him. Meaning, his anointment as king was eternal. Presumably, according to this read, right? So according to the first two reads, the second read assumes that it's not forever, it's just generation. The first read assumes, possibly, that he wasn't even supposed to be dynastic at all. This one assumes that in order to be a king, there has to be a presumption of, maybe not eternity, but right, no specific end. Right? It doesn't have to go forever, just there's no reason that it should end. But Shaul, right, the first two days assume his original kingship was never supposed to be eternal. This shita clearly holds, like that Gemara we saw in Sanhedrin, that it's possible that Shaul was supposed to be king forever, even if there was a Davidic king, a king from Yehuda. It's just possible that you needed, that you would have had both or something. But in principle, Shaul was a king forever. Elamai.
He messed up,
and therefore he stopped being king in his life. Now, did he function as a king in his life? Yes, but there's a famous ambiguity. There's a famous ambiguity. According to Tanakh, how many years is Shaul king? What does Tanakh say? 2 years. How many years does Shaul, according to Pshat in the stories, act as king? A lot more than that. So what is the most likely thing? What does it mean when it says he was king for 2 years? He halachically lost it after two, meaning 2 years in, he sinned, and David was king, but practically, he reigned for many more years, but halachically, he wasn't king. How do you know? Just because people didn't know that he, right? People thought he was a king, but halachically, the chaloy shame, he wasn't a king. Okay. No, he called it, he treated him as Mashiach Hashem, as the one who had been anointed by God, which is true. Right, which is true. Right? So the third day seems to be making a different claim, which is that even though, yes, he still functioned as a king until he died, he wasn't halachically king. Very good. And it would also be clear that this, right, now the first 2 days, presumably, when they talk about king, they mean either they deny this or they just say, okay, but he was still the ruling king and therefore he was king. And this day cares more about the chalos shame.
This
is brisker, exactly. The Gemara says, "Kidni Rabbi Eliezer, Kidni Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Chanina." Like Elazar and Chanina, that b'shash poskim gedula l'adam, that when greatness is taken away from a person, poskim lo ulizaro ad sof kol hadoro, it's taken away from you and your children for generations. Shenemar lo yigra mitzadikena vet melachim lakisei. Right, the pasuk in Eov says something unintelligible, as usual. Right, he withdraws his eyes, not his eyes from the righteous, but with kings upon the throne, he sets them forever, and they are exalted. Thank you. Whatever that means. Vim hegis da'ato, and if he's arrogant, Hakadosh Baruch Hu mashpilo. Shneamar vim asurim bezikim yilachdun bechavayoni. The next pasuk is, and if they be bound in fetters and be held in cords of affliction. Okay. Wow. Now, this daya, I just want to analyze it so far. This daya says what? This daya says what? That Shaul was supposed to be king, presumably forever. But what? But he lost it because he sinned and he was arrogant. Yeah? So now I ask you, I started with a narrative reason to believe this. Right? I pointed to the Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that maybe Yeravam could have been king alongside David, which says that it's not impossible of a king not from Yehuda. Maybe a secondary king, but still. But the second narrative motivation for this might be simply that there's no indication when he's anointed in Perek Yud that it isn't forever. In Tanakh. And therefore, so it could be, and here's what I'm not sure in this third stage in the Gemara, is the Gemara driven by narrative motivations in the story? Namely, there's no indication he wasn't king forever. And because he loses his kingship, and it's a brisker approach, that to be king, you have to have a chaloy shem king. And if he was taken away from even the acting as king, that's not called king. Right? And from that narrative observation, it derives an ethical lesson. That's possibility one. Possibility two is, the Gemara wanted to teach you an ethical lesson, namely that people who sin or people who are arrogant are stripped of their power, and homiletically read it back into Shaul and said, he looked like king but wasn't. I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I'm not sure if there's a way of doing it. My guess is the former in this case. Right? Because the Gemara has three deo, which seem to be motivated by different narrative ways of reading the story, and we saw by Ishbosheth. There's no like, one second, by Ishbosheth, I said, I see no, like, moral reason. No, like, I don't mean moral, like, meaning, it's not teaching you a lesson. There's legitimate narrative reasons to believe that Ishbosheth is a king, namely, it calls him king, and reasons to believe he's not really a king, because he's not king over the whole of Israel. His kingdom is really being propped up by a general who, by snapping his fingers, can move the entire nation over to David in a matter of hours. Right? There's good reasons in the story simply to say he's not really a king. So my guess is that because the first two Deot presume are very plausibly just motivated by different reads of what's going on in Sefer Shmuel, that the third one is also motivated by Shmuel and trying to figure out, was he meant to be king forever? And once you have that, you then pull in the moral thing, right? Well, once you see that he was king and it was stripped of him in his lifetime, and it was because he sinned, you learn that people who sin lose power. The second reason that I'm motivated to say that this started with the narrative of Tanakh and the moral emerged from it, and not that this is just a homiletic drasha, but it's not making a parshanut, is that the ethical lesson seems to have been stated independently of the Shaul story and invoked by the Gemara. Right? That's a... Right? Right? You understand that if the ethical lesson was stated independently and then the Gemara says, oh look, Shaul lost his malchut in his lifetime, oh, that reminds me of this other ethical lesson, it sounds like these are independent. That the Gemara is first making a narrative move, and then when it realizes that according to this read, Shaul lost his kingdom in his lifetime, he brings an ethical lesson. Now, in addition to the fact that that seems to be the implication of the Gemara, it's also the case that you find this statement without the narrative framing in Megillah. So if you look in source number two, the Gemara is quoted in the ethical part of it, right? The didactic part of it is quoted in addition, independently rather, of the narrative component. In Megillah, that Amar Rabbi Elazar, Kishakadosh Baruch Hu, Posik Dula La'adam, Posik Levanav, Levanei Vanav, Asof Kol Adarot, Shenemar Ve'yishim La'nezach Ve'yuv, V'megis Ta'atav, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Mashpilo, Shenemar Ve'yishim Bazikim. Okay? So, my guess is that this story actually is, so that this Gemara actually is, three positions trying to figure out, according to the narrative of Sefer Shmuel, was Shaul originally supposed to be a temporary king? Was he supposed to be a temporary king with a short dynasty? Was he supposed to be a permanent king that maybe existed alongside a Davidic king or something like that? And it's trying to figure out, was Ishbosheth really a king? Is he a king only, you know, sort of, right, but without any of the power, so that's not a real king, right? It's a narrative one, and then along the way, it's deriving ethical lessons from the narrative of Sefer Shmuel. But I will also point out, I will pause just for a second to point out, that obviously, if you don't know Sefer Shmuel, which has become clearly quite evident to me that you don't know Shmuel that well, this story, these few lines in the Gemara are unintelligible, right? Meaning, to understand these like four lines in the Gemara, you have to be deeply familiar with everything from the first, like, starting at like Perek Chet-ish of Shmuel Aleph, all the way to like four Prakim into Shmuel Bet. Otherwise, this whole story makes no sense. You have to be relatively familiar with the narrative of basically half of the entire book of Shmuel. If you don't, this is nonsense. But you understand that you just read four lines, and how much of the background did the Gemara provide you? No. None. If you don't know it, the Gemara just assumes that you know this. The Gemara assumes that you're not reading this story and saying the amazingly strange thing, which the Gemara would be strange, no offense, which is, who's Ishbosheth? Right? If you say, who is Ishbosheth, this Gemara fails. Right? It's like, I'm sure that there are many people in the history of the world, and this is not a good thing, that have read this Gemara and said, oh, what's the machloket? There never was a person Ishbosheth. The Midrash is arguing about whether there was this Midrashic character Ishbosheth. Because I'm sure they have no idea. And they're like, oh, look, the Gemara has a machloket. maybe he had a son named Ishbosheth, and they'll be like, oh, what does that midrashically mean? And they'll never, like, I hope this didn't happen, but in my heart of hearts, I know. I know, right? I think we all know. Exactly. We all know that somewhere in this world, there is somewhere someone reading this Gemara in Zvachim.
In the
document. Whatever. Saying to himself, Ishbosheth, that's not a real name in Tanakh. This must be made up, right? It must be a machloket midrashically whether he had a child who ruled. Again, I hope I'm wrong, but my heart tells me that there is this poor soul somewhere in the world who is an expert in Kudshim and knows Zvachim really well and never opened Sefer Shmuel, so never heard of Ishbosheth. I'm just going to... There's somebody out there. I don't know who he is, and I never want to meet him, right? Except to tell him to read Shmuel. But I'm worried that he does exist. I'm worried. I could be wrong, but I'm worried. Yes, is read Tanakh. Okay, good. That is, like I've never said that lesson to you before. Okay, fine. So now, because I ideally don't want to spend more. Ideally don't want to spend 2 weeks on this, but we'll see. That actually took longer than I thought because, well, I had to actually, you know, spell out the stories for you to make it clear. Let us talk a little bit about, okay, well, what is the ethical lesson that it's trying to teach? So if you look at the Maharal in number 3, so he says, Perush. So first of all, the Maharal notes that it's not actually the case that these are completely independent. He says the message, the ethical message of this Gemara has to be that the default for all positions of honor is that they should be passed down parent to child, which is in fact how the Rambam paskens. Right, the Rambam says that the default for all positions of honor, right, is a Rav, if his son is worthy, should inherit his father's position. Right, the Rambam says, l'halacha, that the default is always, for all positions of honor, that if the son is worthy, right, then the default is that the son should take over. The default in positions of leadership. Again, if he's not worthy, no. What? Leadership positions, right? By Srara. So the Maharal says that, first of all, to understand the ethical lesson, you have to realize that the default is that things are passed on. If that's the case, then making it that it's not passed on is a chisaron. If the default wasn't that it was passed on, then the fact that your kids don't get it is not like a big deal, right? We don't say... Yes. Oh, Avi remembers when we did Yerusha, we did this. Oh, there you go. Yeah, I saw this, Rama. Now you're suddenly both remembering we did this, so yeah, because we said Yerusha of the son is different because he becomes the father. And that's... Yes, very good. Yes, you did. I'm glad we're there. Rai Sarna once told us in Smicha that for a few years at NYU, he would give the same Parsha Shir every single year. And even though a lot of the people who would come year after year would be the same people, they would forget this year. But he said they would almost forget this year. There would be like that little memory in the back of their mind that they forgot that they had heard it. And they would say things like, I don't know how I know this, but I feel like I once heard an answer to this question, right? And they would never put together that's because they heard the same year for the last 3 years in college, right? It's just somewhere buried in their memory. They didn't forget it. Great. So he says, "Sari gamkein im bino ra'u l'malchu bino kodem alakol v'im yorish mamono kol shekein sheyorish esra shalaviv." Right? If you inherit money, for sure you inherit position. Why he thinks that's for sure, I'm not sure. Va'od ki aben yesh lo chibur v'tziruv alaviv v'im aviv melech aben hu ben melech. Right? And you're connected to your father. So if the king has a son, he's a prince. V'zeh ben karav al-malchu, therefore he is closer to it. Rakim magbia atzmo hakadosh baruch hu mashpilo. Right? So what's the Maharal's point? Is that it's not just, right, this story only makes sense, or it doesn't only make sense. The lesson is stronger if you realize that what? That there is a default, right? If you realize there's a default, so then the fact that you are, you know, not getting it is a bigger deal, right? No?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I mean, this is not like a huge chiddush, but I think it's, well, yeah, I mean, again, okay, fine. So that is the first point that you have to make. Now, you also have to figure out, well, what exactly is the drasha? What is the drasha here? Okay, how do we prove it from this pasuk in Eov? Because Eov is, sure, confusing, that's a word. I've probably told you before, I've definitely told you before, but one of my professors in YU had worked on the JPS translation of Tanakh. And if you know in the JPS Tanakh, when there's phrases that people don't understand, that like none of the Parshanim know, they write a little asterisk and they put at the bottom, meaning of Hebrew uncertain. And he said they were very tempted when they got to Eov to put a little asterisk at the beginning of the book and just say, meaning of book uncertain, right? It is insanely confusing. No.
How many books are there written on
Eov? A bunch. So Eov, again, the pasuk is Lo yigra mitzadik einav et melachim lakiseh ve'yoshevim lanesach va'yigbahu. Right, he does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but with kings upon the throne, he sets them forever, and they are exalted. And then pasuk chet is. And if they are bound in fetters and held in cords of affliction, dot, 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 dot. So what does this mean? Right? So, right now, it continues, which is he tells them of their sins, and they've been, right, really, the truth is you probably look at the next pasuk, which is, tet, which is Vayagam Palam Vashem Yit Gabar. He tells them their sins. Vayigal Aznat Musavrim Shuun Me'afen. He turns them back from their sins. Right? He keeps going on, right? And if he doesn't, he punishes them. Okay. So, what exactly is the meaning here? Okay. So, here you have different Perushim. So, we look at Rashi on our Gemara. He says, Damarim Higis, Vayig Bahu, Vayi, right, which is if he's arrogant, Higis Libo, Vim Asurim Bezikim, Gavhut Libam Gorem Liot Asurim Bezikim, Ktubichav Leoni. That if they are arrogant, so they're led to be in chains, essentially, right? So Rashi in Megillah as well says, Ayidei Shem Magbim Atzman, if they're arrogant, Bon Lidei Aniyut V'Yisurim. Right, they come to poverty and suffering. So Rashi is very clear that the drusha here is, first of all, the sin is arrogance, and the drusha is if they're arrogant, then they get Asurim, they're imprisoned, or suffering. Sorry, from Yisurim. Okay? The Marsha though says, "Safe at the Krad Leil, Lo Yigrav Inzak Eino, Uperek Amizbech Mikdash Mighty Law Nami Hachdash Al Masa Shaul." The Pasuk Lo Gedula La Olam. Right, he says the Gemara and right, brings this by Shaul. El Shimenu Ayidei Shigbi Asim Kazad Vesirim Bezikim. Uperes Rashi Ayidei Shemagmin Asim Binyli Daniel Vesirim. Nira Mi Perusho Asurim Lashon Yisurim. Right, so Rashi says that the drasha is that if you're arrogant, you will suffer. That's the drasha. And the psukim are talking about kings, so it works very well. Yeah? Aval milad v'im eno nofel bo. The problem is, look back at the pasuk. What is v'im asurim bazikim? Right? V'im means an if. According to Rashi, it's an if then. But the way the pasuk reads is, if then X, and if Y, then Z. Right, v'im seems to be part of a second clause, not the, it's not the then, It's the if number two. So therefore he says, Al Karch Nir Lafarit Lavidrasha Zuv, Im Shayasu Isurim. He thinks that the drasha is not asurim, but isurim. Is if you do usur things, Kimosha Asa Shaul, Shechamal al Agag Vaharag Nir, no, Irakoanim, Bauli de Zikim. If you do usur things, you will suffer. Vim Kamoainu Shagbio Shiasu Isurim. And if you're arrogant, what it's saying is if you're arrogant or whatever, you'll end up doing usur things. Okay, so at some level, they're just arguing about semantics, literally, right, with the words, which is, how does the drasha work? Is it, if you're arrogant, then something, or if you're arrogant, it'll lead to Isurim, and then you'll be punished, okay? But, really, this is pointing to, yeah, I think it's better if we just take an extra few minutes now and finish it now. Another narrative point here. What's the obvious narrative point you have to answer in let's say, another 5 to 10 minutes? Let's try to answer it. What's the obvious question you need to ask in the book? The Pasuk says that the sin he did was arrogance. Is that what the sin is? Well? Okay, good. Very good. What sins lead to Shaul losing his malchut? Which sins? I want you to be precise, people. How many times does he lose the malchut? How many times does Shmuel tell him he loses the malchut? Yes, more than once. Very good. What parak are you up to in Shmuel? So you still forgot both of these prakim. So the second one is Amalek. But in Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Gimel, his first sin is that what? He goes to war. He's about to go to war. And Shmuel says, wait for me to bring the carbon. And he doesn't. Right? He doesn't. Why doesn't he? Right? Right, they're waiting 7 days, and he just gets impatient, and he brings it. And Shmuel yells at him. And Shmuel says, "Vayomer Shmuel Shaul, niskalta lo shamarta mitzvah Adonai lecha asher tzivcha, ki ata echein Adonai mamlecha Yisrael ad olam." What, you failed, because, and now, in case you were wondering, was he going to be king forever? Yes, he says, if you hadn't, now we get an answer to that question. Right, which is, had you not sinned, you should have been king forever. Right, that's the third day in the Gemara, which also makes you wonder the first 2 days out. Which is, wait a second, the pasuk says he was supposed to be king forever. So why the first 2 days don't imply that he isn't? So again, ad olam could be not necessarily forever, but I don't know. Va'ata mamlachta lo takum b'keish Adonai lo ish kilvavo v'itzevei Adonai le'negil amo kiloshem mar de'asher tzivcha Adonai. Right, I don't. So now you're not going to be king. Two prakim later, he famously fails by Agag. He doesn't kill Agag. He doesn't kill the animals. Right? So God takes away the malchut from him. Again, the obvious problem that everyone asks is, okay, his first sin is he didn't wait for Shaul. The second one, he didn't kill all of Amalek. Oze, the sin is not arrogance. It's not just that. What is the one thing we know about him before is that he's not arrogant. He's humble. Oh, very good. So, so good. So here's what you get. Is that very good? So the Iyun Yaakov says, so what does it come to? So the Iyun Yaakov says, well, it depends. One way of reading this story is, reading the Gemara is that he had a bunch of sins. Right? He started off humble, but then eventually became arrogant, and he didn't wait for Shaul, and he didn't kill all of Amalek. He did a bunch. That's his first answer. Right? He says, it's not just arrogance, it's any sin. The point is, if you don't do what God said, you don't be king. It's because of this, it's because he killed Nov later on. Remember that story? That's also fascinating, because he lost the kingdom way before he killed Nov, but okay, fine. So possibility one is that really what the Gemara's lesson is, if you sin, you lose power. And what drives the Inyan Yaakov to make that move in Parshanut? Because Shaul's sins are not obviously because of arrogance. The other possibility is that the Gemara is making a move in Parshanut and telling you that you think you know what the sin is. But let me tell you what was underlying those sins. And that is his next answer, which is he said the first sin, at least, was arrogance, for sure, which was Shmuel told him, wait, you need the Navi to bring the Karban out, and he didn't wait because he didn't feel like he needed to. One second, is that arrogance? Yeah. He said he also asked Rav Batumim, which he wasn't supposed to do because he wasn't king anymore. Okay, fine. Now, he doesn't tie it, very good, he doesn't tie it to the second one, to the Amalek one, but yes, I would argue that you very easily can make a Parshanut move here and say, yes, he didn't kill Amalek, but what does that show? Yeah, he thinks he knows better than God. Now, because it just finished being Rav Lichtenstein's yard site, maybe I'll very briefly share you with Rav Lichtenstein's vort on this. So Rav Lichtenstein argues that in Pshat, he thinks that's not why Shaul was killed. That's right, why Shaul lost his malchut. Lichtenstein has a brilliant read, and he says that Shaul lost his malchut because of genocide. He'll tell me, my genocide. So Lichtenstein says very simple. He takes a Kierkegaardian approach, and he says there are two systems that work simultaneously. There's ethics, and there's Dvar Hashem. There are two systems. I've discussed it before, but his yard site just finished like half an hour ago. So there's two systems that work in tandem. Ethics and the word of God. Normally, they overlap. Okay? But in theory, ontologically, Dvar Hashem overrides ethics. Therefore, Rav Lichtenstein argues that your default is you have to be ethical. What's the only heter to not be ethical? God said so. But he says, what happens? So he says like this. If he had killed everybody, then Shaul would say, I'm not making any decisions. I'm doing what God said. I'm not imposing my own moral values. But what happens when he killed everybody except the person he didn't want to kill and except the animals? Then he's making the cheshbonot, which means, is he killing everybody because God said so? No, it's because he had no problem killing everybody else. He only had a problem killing Shaul. The second he did that, it transformed from being a kiyum with Dvar Hashem into genocide. Right? So that's what Lichtenstein's for. That really, now, of course, can that be connected back to arrogance? Yes, obviously. Because, right, the point is that really the core of it is that what made this so egregious is that if you had said, listen, I don't know why you tell me to kill everybody, but God said so and I'm listening, so then fine. But if you say, God said it, but I'm going to do it better, I know the right way to do it, it's not just arrogance. The arrogance, right? Yeah, it implies that you're okay with this, that you think that you can decide who lives and dies. That's all. Only God can decide. So you definitely can see arrogance at some level of being a driving force in the sin. But it's interesting that the Ion Yaakov, in his first answer, doesn't seem to believe that.
Well, he also said you can override what Shmuel told him.
For sure. That's his second answer, though. Right? His second answer is that his sins are expressions of Gaava. His first answer is that, no, the sin was not listening to Shmuel. Right? Which is fascinating, because in that slight little thing, the Ion Yaakov is giving you two very different perspectives on Sefer Shmuel. Right? One is, his sin was Pshuto Kimashmo. He was supposed to listen to Shmuel, he didn't. The other is, it was his entire attitude that was problematic, that expressed itself in sin. But the reason he lost his malchut is not because of the local sins, but because of what they said about his personality. Right? Now that obviously is going to be very important, and this could take forever to figure out why the age-old question, which is why David, who seems to do worse sins, like adultery and having someone murdered and things like that, why does he keep his malchut? Now part of it is that he does tshuva, and Shaul doesn't, right? Each time he's accused, Shaul says, no, I did what I said. I did what you were supposed to do. Another answer is their personal sins versus national sins. But part of it might also be an attitude question, which is that David, he does sin, but when he's called out for it, he says, I'm wrong. Right? And you see how at some level being arrogant makes you impervious to change, and that might be worse, even if the sin itself is not as egregious. Right? Like, clearly, you would say that bringing a carbon early is not as bad as adultery and killing someone's, having someone's husband killed in war. Clearly, if I had to pick, I would have picked, you know, bringing the carbon 5 minutes early. But on the other hand, you could say, but there's a personality difference. And yeah, that might be part of the fact that David does tshuva immediately and Shaul doesn't, right? That each time Shaul calls him out, what does he always say? I did. No, he says, I did what God said, right? By the Amalek one, he says, why didn't you do it? And he said, I did. Right? I did exactly what I was supposed to. But again, what you see is that in this slight nuance in the Agadata is when the Agadata says that you lose your malchut for arrogance, is that saying you lose it for sin, and therefore I don't have to look for the underlying ethical flaw in Shaul that led to his sin? Or is it telling you something profound about all the sins of Shaul and what exactly led to him sinning? Right? You understand how this little point sheds light on large swaths of the narrative in Sefer Shmuel. Yeah, but he was also very humble at the beginning. But sure, maybe he becomes arrogant because he's, you know, tall and good looking. I don't know. But at the beginning, he's clearly not like that. But again, we could spend hours on this. But my point is simply that this little agadic point is pointing to two very different reads of the narrative in Shmuel. The last one I'll show you just for a minute, where he says, V'kasha, lomo maiti r'lazer, in lemak shaboskin gudul b'vada hu l'dorot, imkein, agak v'sho l'dorot, paskuo v'amatsinu v'moshe, lehem elfo lo l'dorot. He says, is it really true that greatness is always l'dorot? We already said Moshe isn't. He says, maybe it's only when God gives you gedula. This is also an interesting thing. That Moshe wasn't made king, right? Shaul was made king. And therefore, the assumption of being made king by God, and Nimshach, is as forever. So first of all, he takes this amazing parshanut, because he says, the Gemara makes a claim that the default is that all malchut is forever, right? The third day on the Gemara is that it's forever. I, Moshe Rabbeinu. So he comes up with this wild, far-reaching claim, which is Shaul was made king, Moshe just was king. Yeah, he just said, Vahi Rishun Melech, Avalomazinu Psika. Not ever gave him the king. He didn't give him kingship, he just was king. Now that is like a fascinating, it just strikes me that this Sfat Emet is like opens worlds. It's like, what exactly is the unique nature of Moshe? It's not, he just is king. He's not, no one has to make him king, right? There's someone being appointed king, and then there's just, you are king. You're just the man, right? Exactly, which is a fascinating, like the Sfat Emet is like swallowing this like amazing theory. And then he says, okay, the simple shot, at least from Rashi, is that his sin was arrogance. He says he wasn't arrogant. Adraba. Now, he doesn't say, like, the Yonako, maybe his sins were caused by arrogance. He said, we see at the beginning of the story that he didn't want to be king. He hid amongst the Kalim rather than be appointed. Now, there's an easy answer to the spot I met, which is, he was humble, and then power got to his head. This is like, but apparently, Sfat Emet is not willing to buy this. If you ask me, the simple shot is, he was humble, and then power got to his head, and that's what the story is telling you. Sfat Emet is not willing to buy this. He's like, he was humble, so clearly, his problem wasn't arrogance. Uktiv katana deinecha, v'tu, lama liyatam da'gazim, ofurus b'krush, nidl menu amalchab, malo shama'al. And he said, besides, why come up with arrogance? The Torah says something else. V'tzaruch iyun. He just says, I don't know. So again, the answer is one of two. Either the first day on Yin Yaakov, which is the real lesson of the story is that sin leads to you losing power. It doesn't have to be arrogance. It's just an example. Or what I think is more plausible, which is the second answer of the Yin Yaakov, is no. You always have to ask two questions. One is, what was your sin? And the second is, what is your character flaw that leads to sin? And the Gemara is teaching you a lesson, which is that you want to understand the core of Shaul's sins. It's hubris. And that's what manifests itself in not waiting for Shaul, in deciding how to carry out the the attack against Amalek without following God's rules. And if you want to go with the biblical saying, that arrogance led it to being defined as genocide, because now he was making the decisions and not just doing what God said. My main takeaway, though, from this story is that, so what you see in this short Agadata is that it's actually making very profound, very far-reaching claims about the stories. In basically, these like five lines of the Gemara force you to give you perspective, but force you to understand and analyze what is going on in large, large swaths of Sefer Shmuel, which you have to realize that sometimes Chazal just assume you know Tanakh. So they write a short Agadata, but they're really telling you something profound about the whole book. But you don't get it unless you know the whole book. What? Yes! Yes! Okay.